Hello and welcome to the 21st episode of the New York Film Academy Hour. I'm so excited today because we have an amazing guest. His fingerprints are all over film history. And if you've seen Jurassic Park, Beetlejuice, Ghostbusters, you know his work. Stay tuned to find out more.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Hello, it's just me today because Pega is out. We wish her well. She'll be back soon. She's vacationing, enjoying the sun and fun. Today, we have a very special guest. His name is Craig Caton. It rhymes with Satan. That's how I'm remembering it today. He is the New York Film Academy Chair of Animation and Visual Effects. And as I said earlier, his fingerprints are all over Hollywood classics, to name a few: Jurassic Park, Tangled, Apollo 13, Fright Night, Beetlejuice, Tremors, Batman Returns, Ghostbusters, Meet the Robinsons, one of my favorite, most underrated movies ever, Interview with a Vampire, Big Trouble in Little China, Predator 2, Shark Tale, Edward Scissorhands, and Terminator 2, Judgment Day. He's worked all over the effects departments, including special effects, visual effects, character design, and even puppeteering. He's here today to talk to us about his amazing career. Thank you so much for being with us today, Craig.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. Yeah. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. So. You're one of those fellows that I pass all the time. You've got Batman on your tags for work. We talk about it. And then someone was like, see, the Batman symbol, just always prepared. And then someone's like, you know, Craig's done everything. And I said, I don't know that Craig has done everything. And they filled me in and I was like, oh, we have to bring him in. We have to talk to him about his amazing career. I want to check out your reel because I feel like I could talk about this forever, but your reel just, it shows the genius. Let's check it out. Ah! For those of you listening just on audio, it's a Jurassic Park raptor scene in the kitchen. Tearing people apart. We've got T2. He's got the hole blown in his face. Oh my god, so cool. Groundbreaking at the time, for those of you who probably weren't alive because you guys are young. But it was amazing. Predator 2! We're looking at the jaws, the mandibles covered in slime. Batman Returns with our penguin engineer taking flight. It's just great. Ghostbusters and Slimer, who was everyone's favorite, because let's be real about it, it's Slimer. The Freaky Ghosts, they did a really fun job reanimating in the new one. The guy blows up in Big Trouble in Little China. That's Craig! Tremors! Giant earwig-looking things bursting from the sand. What a gross movie, but so cool! And, of course, the original Fright Night, which I like the remake, but don't sleep on the original. It is great. Full of classic Hollywood horror scenes. Flaming skeletons. I've already did Poltergeist 2 as well. Some of these amazing, creepy, alien, otherworldly things. The best scene in Beetlejuice, don't at me. It's just amazing. Dinner scene, shrimp hands, it's wonderful. Holy cow, Craig. Okay, let me compose myself. Okay, so we always start with the exact same question.
Okay.
And that question is, when did you first know you were in love with movies?
Oh, when I was about 7 or 8 years old and I saw the original Planet of the Apes.
Yes! Okay, so my favorite thing about this show is that when I ask this question, 99.9% of times everyone has a horror film. I like that you have a sci-fi horror film.
Uh-huh.
Because that is where I fell in love with the movies.
Right.
I started, my dad's a pure like sci-fi junkie. That's where we start. Okay, so take me there. Planet of the Apes. What's happening in your mind?
Well, I saw Planet of the Apes, and I was just blown away by the makeups. And after I saw the movie, the only thing I could think of was, and this is kind of goofy, was like I kept saying to myself, hey, I want to be a monkey too. Not really thinking that full thing through. So I lived on a farm up in Washington State. And so I started going to the library and reading whatever I could. And finally I found this, in a magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland, where a lot of us, people in the '80s got our start by reading this magazine. In the back of the magazine was an ad for a makeup Monster Manual by the legendary Dick Smith. And for $2.50 you could you could get this. And so I did. I got a copy of that. And then over like between the fifth grade and the sixth and the seventh grade, all I did was try to make Planet of the Apes makeups. And, yes. And what I did is I went out to the corral and I had a horse named Eagle and I trimmed his mane so I could use the mane for my Planet of the Apes hair. And surprisingly enough, my dad didn't get really mad for doing that. But yeah, a couple like by the like my first one was all was plaster. I mean, it was a paper mache.
Wow.
And then finally I figured out, oh, they're using this stuff called foam latex. And so I saved up a bunch of money because when you're 11 years old, $70 for a foam latex kit's quite a bit.
Yeah.
Sent that away, started doing it. And finally, a couple of years later, I had perfected a Planet of the Apes makeup. But by that time, I was so, and I was applying it to myself. So I was, and it was like, wow, when you put these makeups on, you become a different character. And because you're kind of in disguise or something, it gives you this great freedom to explore and become something entirely different. And so by that time, I was hooked. So from the sixth grade on out, all I wanted to do was come down to Hollywood and make monster movies.
Okay, so Planet of the Apes, you become obsessive about doing the makeup and putting everything in. When do you start taking that into a career? When do you start, you know, working on sets? Are, do you go to school first? Are you diving in straight? Are you making your own movies?
Well, what it was there were no schools back then for it or anything like that.
Oh.
And there wasn't even computers. So not yet. I was in college and like I said, I had found this book by Dick Smith, this monster makeup manual. And I was looking through this other book in the library called The Who's Who of America, which was a popular thing back then. And there inside Who's Who of America was Dick Smith's address and phone number.
Oh, what?
Because he was like one of the big wigs of makeup industry, the makeup effects industry and stuff. And
wow.
So I grabbed a couple of photographs and I wrote him a letter. And I sent him this letter saying, you know, hey, I really like your stuff. You know, thank you for your inspiration and in making this manual. And a week later, I get a phone call in Portland, Oregon. He was on the East Coast in New York. And he tells me, and I thought it was a prank call. I thought it was my college roommates pranking me, right? Hey, we're going to let's punk Craig with the dick call. But no, it was Dick Smith. And he said what he wanted me to do was he gave me like six different makeups, like an old age makeup and some other like a disfigured makeup and a special effects makeup and some other stuff. And he said he wanted me to do those makeups and then take pictures of them and then send those pictures to him along with a blank audio cassette and a page of questions. And then he would critique the makeups on tape, and then he would answer all my questions on the tape as well.
Wow.
But the thing was, is he would go off on these amazingly great tangents.
What?
So he'd be back. This is back in the late 80s, and he was developing this brand new paint formula that he called PAX, P-A-X, that was made for like doing rubber monsters.
Wow.
And so he would be answering my questions and all of a sudden he would just veer off. Hey, I'm working on this new stuff called PAX paint and here's the formula and here's how you make it. And all of a sudden I have his formula and I'm doing this stuff before, you know, 90% of the people here in Los Angeles are even doing it. So what I did was, you know, that this went on for about a year. And then at one point, we're talking on the phone and he says he sees no reason for me not to come down to California from Portland, Oregon and give it a go. So I come down here and Dick introduced me to like the three big people of special effects makeup of that time, which at the time was Rick Baker and Stan Winston and a guy named Tom Berman.
Good Lord.
And so, yeah, so it was great. He gave me these introductions. And after moving down here, about 2 weeks later, I had a job working at a company here in the Valley called Makeup Effects Labs. And it was on a little Charlie Band 3D movie called Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin. And so we were, you know, that was my first movie working on stuff like that. But that's how I got into the business was through Dick Smith, you know, through like a mentorship.
This is thing. Like a fairy tale.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was like the 80s was like the golden years for all of us and that stuff. So yeah.
That is incredible. You met all the greats, started right away. Okay, so where do you start in the industry? Are you starting as an assistant? Are you what is your position? What's your role?
Well, here's what I did for the first 2 weeks. I wasn't even paid. I was sweeping and organizing the shop.
Oh,
but
goodness.
There was this really great diabolical plan involved with that because they said, hey, Craig, why don't you just like reorganize the shop and put things where you think they should be and stuff like that? Well, 2 weeks later, I was the only person in the shop who knew where everything was.
Because
I reorganized everything.
That's brilliant.
And so all of a sudden I became like this indispensable person at that shop because, hey, we need toothpaste or toothpicks or whatever. And like, oh, they're over here. Oh, thank you.
I want to take a moment and pause for future students here. A, this is definitely a fairy tale storied rise and probably will not happen for you. And two, make yourself indispensable by switching where everything is.
That's right.
Stick around. That's incredible.
If you're the only person who knows, they can't get rid of you.
It's true. Magnificent. Okay, so how do you? So you're organizing. When do they start letting you put the makeup on the people?
Well, about 2 weeks into it, they had been working on that movie, Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin, and the movie had wrapped up filming. But they were coming back to do pickup shots, right? And so they wanted to add a couple of scenes where they had these like little sand monsters that come out of the ground and bite people and stuff. And they didn't have those completely yet. They were sculpted and molded, but they hadn't been fabricated. And so that was my first job. Was they, you know, they gave me like some a skin of this creature and his jaw, and they said, "Here, make this a monster." And a puppet. And so that was like one of my first puppets was putting that together and building it.
So I want to take a moment to talk about puppets. You're our first puppeteer on the show. I'm endlessly fascinated by puppets. I think they're amazing. I'm currently working on a story where we're going to shoot most of it with puppets. So I want to ask you, when did puppets come into play for you? Was it, you know, they asked you to and you're like, I need to figure this out? Or had you already been experimenting with puppeteering?
I had been experimenting with it because what I was finding was that I had done tons and tons of makeup effects on people's faces, you know, turning them into aliens and whatever. And all of a sudden I was finding the human face so limited because, you know, you're always trapped with the, you know, you have two eyes and a nose and a mouth and you kind of have to pay attention to that stuff. And I wanted to break away from that. So I started doing puppets so I could build stuff that didn't have to rely on human anatomy. And that's so I'd already built like a little werewolf puppet, and I'd built it was kind of like an eel puppet. So it's kind of like an underwater cool eel puppet that I had built. And so that was kind of how that got started.
So outside of maybe Jim Henson and some larger Broadway productions, you probably have some of the most well-known puppets either operating or helping having a hand in creating.
Yeah.
I guess we'll just start with Beetlejuice because it's one of my favorite movies, and that scene is one of my favorite scenes of all times. If you haven't seen Beetlejuice, just pause here and go watch it. It's like the most hilarious film maybe of all time. Tim Burton directs. It's weird. It's quirky. And there's this dinner party scene. The house is haunted by ghosts. Beetlejuice is not happy. The ghosts want them out. Shrimp cocktail fingers burst from a plate. Is this in the script? Is it completely conceptualized in the script, or are you kind of playing around with things and trying to?
No, that one was completely storyboarded and in the script and everything beforehand. So we just kind of did it by the numbers. But here's the thing: it took 4 days to shoot that shot.
Oh my goodness.
And I was the hand that came out of the salad and pushes the big guy over the table, right? So I got the nice close-ups, which was great. But the thing was you remember the song they were playing?
Is it the "Come, Mr. Tallyman, Tally Me Banana"?
So, we did that sequence. We did it for 4 days. They only played about a 30 second long piece of that music. every take over and over for 4 days, 8 hours or 9 hours a day. So we had heard that little clip like thousands of times in 4 days. And I was like so sick of like, Deo, daylight come in, you want to throw up. And so that was... We're so glad to be done with that scene.
I'm sure that at some point where there are like a lot of earplugs on set. How do you get, like, when that happens, you obviously have to pay attention to it because you have to use the cues for you.
Yeah.
Is crew running around with earplugs and trying to tune the song out, or do you just have to live with it?
They're just living with it.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy, that is brutal.
It's just, you know, just go with it and hopefully you'll get over it someday.
Oh, man. Let's go into Ghostbusters and Slimer.
Ghostbusters.
Okay, so... Correct me. Slimer is a combination puppet and early CGI, or
no
early,
CGI.
It? No, yeah. It's 100% a puppet in 100% the original.
What we kind of faked is we shot his name. He's the Slimer ghost. You know what his real name is? His
no.
real name is Onionhead.
What?
And he is the ghost of John Belushi, because you know John had passed away,
yeah.
And of course all the people there were big friends. They were all friends, and so this was. The puppeteers in the group, we all watched, we watched Animal House and we watched the food fight sequence, and we used that as our inspiration for the Slimer Ghost or for Onionhead.
I had no idea. That's such a touching tribute.
And so I was his mouth operator. And so he had this big wire for his mouth and then this great big pole. So I would hide underneath him with this pole and operate his mouth. And then inside the suit or the costume was a wonderful puppeteer, lived right here in Burbank. His name is Mark Wilson. And so he was actually inside the suit with the arms. And so he would grab the food, which was real food. It was real Jell-O and real mashed potatoes and real bread, and he would shove it into the Slimer's mouth, and it would go through his body and end up on my face. and so I had a face mask on, right, and all that stuff, which was fine, but. At the end of the day, we were all wearing black puppeteer costumes.
Oh, boy.
And every day my suit was just reeking with rotting food. And I would take it to the same dry cleaners down in Marina Del Rey. And like the first day, they're like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, $5. We'll clean that for you. By the second month, they're like, oh, that's going to take like $35 to clean that. The price just kept going up and up and
How
up and up.
Shady. And, come on, guys. But, guys got to live.
But
how many puppets do you have for Slimer then? Because you're going to get messy and get involved in practical food.
Well, he would get wiped up, but he actually consisted of four puppets.
Oh.
There was the normal puppet that we see a lot. And then there was this one puppet that was built specifically for a drinking scene. So his mouth is all like this. And he comes out of like a hot dog cart and he's drinking a bottle.
Yeah, yeah.
That was just for that one shot, right? And then we had another our puppet of the Slimer Ghost, where his mouth was deliberately sculpted way overextended. So it was like really huge open mouth so he could get those great big screaming scenes. And then one of the other tiny puppets we built a puppet that was about this big. He looked like a little potato spud.
Oh.
And he's the little one that you see roaming around inside the chandeliers when they're inside that building.
That's really cool.
So there was another little puppet too that was that we used, but it was about the same size, a tiny little one. But yeah, we shot them all against black, right?
Okay.
And we kind of used, it was kind of an old Hollywood technique where we shot him. He was very, very overlit. We shot him at 18 frames a second, so everything he did would look speeded up.
Yeah.
And a little frenetic. And then since he was shot on black, then they would just straight comp him onto film like a double exposure.
Makes sense.
So that way he actually, you know, and he's going to look a little transparent just because he's double exposed. But that was the whole trick. Because
he's a ghost.
This is the whole gag.
Man.
It was really clever.
So many
what they did.
Cool Hollywood tricks in such a short amount of time. You just said, that's really cool. Slimer is just the best. We talked Beetlejuice. Let's do Batman Returns, and then we'll go into Jurassic Park and talk dinosaurs.
Batman Returns.
So we're both big Batman heads. I don't think that's a shocker to anyone. When you get the call to work on Batman Returns, what reaction?
Well, That was a dream come true.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I was 6 or 7 years old, I was like the biggest Batman fan of the 60s on television with
Batman 66, the classic.
Yeah, yeah, with Adam West and Burt Ward as Batman and Robin. In fact, I had to go into the hospital, and I didn't know the hospital had television. I was only like 4 or 5 years old, right? And I had to go home. I insisted I have to get released from the hospital so I can go home and watch Batman on that one night.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, you'll be here. I was like, yeah, but I don't know if you get Batman on your televisions in the hospital. I have to go home. And they actually let me go home so I could go watch. And they let me out of the hospital early so I could go home and watch Batman.
It's a good hospital. They understand the importance of Batman in a child's life.
Exactly.
Yeah, I grew up on Batman the Animated Series.
And such a wonderful show. And Kevin Conroy is the voice of Batman.
You can't hear anyone else between him and...
Mark Hamill.
Yes, playing
the
Joker.
Voice of Joker.
I can't read Joker and not hear Mark Hamill's voice anymore when reading the comics.
And it was so great that the two of them went ahead and did all the video games that Rocksteady did. That was just so much icing on the cake, and just made those video games, you know.
Yeah, the storytelling in those games is phenomenal, but when you get down to the voices and suddenly you're like, I'm playing the game, and they made a VR one, which I haven't played yet.
Yeah, me neither.
Ooh, it's high on the list of things to play.
Yep.
But you were on Batman Returns. You did the penguin scene?
We did mechanical penguins, yeah.
Oh, the perfect age for Batman Returns. Like, I know a lot of people are like, oh, why? It's kind of corny. But I really, even to this day, enjoy the aspects of it because it combines, like, a Batman 66 with the 90s style, like, epic, muscled out Batman.
Yeah.
And it brings those two worlds together, which if you're a fan of Batman across any time span, you can really enjoy that.
It works,
Yeah, and the penguins are part of that glory. They're, like, have jetpacks on and they're rocketing into space.
Yeah.
How does that scene come together? Is it the same way as before, where it was completely storyboarded and ready to go?
There was a lot of storyboards going on, but they were like just great, great big group shots of these penguins, and so there was a lot of that. We would get to the stage the day before, and we would dress the penguins into the set, and then they would like they would have the basic camera shots already, but we'd dress them, and then they would like change the shots a little bit.
So
they were kind of locked in because. We had 30 penguin puppets, okay?
Holy
so we had 10 penguin puppets of these three different sizes.
Are these hand puppets or are they on strings?
They were fully controlled, like animatronic heads and necks and mouths that opens, wings that would flap. And then since they were, and then we would drill holes into the ground, and then you could put a person underneath the set to one on a backpack to move them around, the other one to like walk with their little feet with little pegs and their little rods. And so there were three different sizes. There were 10 of these little like 10-inch Blackfoot penguins, and then there were 10 of these like 28-30-inch penguins, which were called Emperor penguins. They're the ones with little oranges on. Emperor penguins, yeah. And then we had a couple of great big ones, which were little people inside suits that we had. But we also had real penguins on that set too. We had real Emperor penguins and we had real Blackfoot penguins.
That kind of hit me and then it hit me again. Somebody was on set directing penguins while puppeting was happening.
Here's the cool that so all these little penguins are like the little Blackfoot penguins are evil and vicious. They're just mean.
Like in real life?
Yeah, no, in real life, yeah.
But no, and penguins are so
like,
cute.
Here's the thing we did, right? We shouldn't have done it, but we did. It's like a guy named Andy Schoenberg and I, the two guys in charge of the puppets. And we took one of our little tiny Blackfoot penguins that was dressed on set, and we put a real herring in its mouth, which is what the little penguins were eating, right? Then a real Blackfoot penguin came up to it and looked at it. He pecked his head. Immediately broke his eye mechanism.
Oh my God.
Then he stole the herring and ate the herring. And then just to add measure, he like pecked the head again. But what he did is he ended up ripping off like half of the side of the face. And then Andy and I felt really stupid because we spent the rest of the day fixing the head. But he was just vicious, right? Now the bigger penguins, the Empire penguins, the ones with the little orange circles on their head, they're like golden retrievers. All they want you to do is come up to them and scratch them behind their little ear holes. And they're like, this is the best.
I like those penguins better. sound adorable.
And one day, and they had 10 of those. And one day after the shoot was over, the penguin wrangler, this really great doctor guy, he only had 9 penguins in his cage, where in the place where the penguins were, and one was gone. And it came back, and it turns out one of the penguins was cuddled up and sleeping with our penguin puppets on set, and it was so cute because he was just there leaning against, snuggled up against one of our puppets, and
my whole heart is breaking.
It was really, really cool.
That is so beautiful. How many puppeteers did you have on that?
It was huge. We had about 60 puppeteers.
Jesus. What a production. Were you involved in coordinating them at all, or?
Yeah. I was there were about 4 of us from Stan Winston's at the time that we were the on-set supervisors. So we had 2 people, I believe Karen Mason and Andy Schoenberg, who were the artistic coordinators and supervisors on our set. And then myself and another really great guy, his name is Jeff Edwards, we were the mechanical coordinators on the show.
Okay.
And so the between the 4 of us, we all basically corralled the rest of those puppeteers.
Incredible.
And they were amazing and professional people. And a lot of that has to do with the woman that we hired, or that Stan hired to hire an addition to puppeteers. She was just amazing, and she'd done a lot of work previously in this business as well. Her name is Mary Claypool, by the way. Wonderful lady. So
awesome. I mean, I really like the scene with the penguins, and I never would have thought like 60 people were involved in making that happen, just in getting the puppets to move. Not talking crew. What an enormous undertaking. For a little long time, so I want to switch into Jurassic Park mode, which has maybe the best puppets ever for things that aren't supposed to look like puppets. Like I like when there's stylized puppets that, you know, you can tell from far. You're like, a puppet, but it looks cool. It's doing a thing. People are still getting tripped up over Steven Spielberg and that Triceratops, where they're like, real dinosaur? What's happening? Is it perfectly reserved? What is going on? It's like mechanics and puppetry is what went into this. You did perhaps everyone's favorite one, the raptors in the kitchen scene. You told me before we started that you had a story, and I just have to admit, I'm too eager to hear it. I'm very excited.
Okay, so here's so a lot of the shots in the of the raptors was just me with this big close-up head. So it's just this big hand puppet, right? And first off, I'm gonna dispel things by saying I used Kermit the Frog's voice for the raptors on set, so. Even though they were like these scary dinosaurs, they're like, all right, everybody, I'm coming through the kitchen door now. and so that helped a little bit to keep, you know. But even so, people look and they come up and they go, can I touch it? Oh, my gosh. And it still had that great mystique to it. But anyway, the kitchen door scene, the little porthole window that the raptor looks through, that was me in a hand puppet, right? Now, my favorite movie of all time is Alien, okay?
Yeah.
Love Alien. And in the end of Alien, when Sigourney Weaver is trying to escape the ship with Jonesy the cat and the little cat character, she comes around the corner and is face-to-face with the alien, right? But she drops Jonesy the cat in his carrier on the ground and she takes off. Thanks, Sigourney, said Jonesy. Right? And then, but there's this great shot of the alien looking in on the cat and twisting his head. And you can just right then and there, you can see the intelligence of that alien, because he's just like, what? He's like doing this little quizzical thing, right? So I'm telling my other 2 puppeteers that are with me that, hey, I'm going to do this shot from Alien where we do the head twist thing and you know, in the door. And they're going, okay, yeah, we're with you. And so I get around to the front of the – I'm looking in through the window. I turn the raptor's head to look straight into the window, and I start twisting the head to do that little alien bit, right, the little xenomorph thing. And some guy way in the back says, you're twisting the head. You're twisting the head. And then Steven Spielberg yells out, it's just like Alien. I love it. Keep doing it. And I'm like, he gets it. He totally got it.
Spielberg knows your movie reference from a tilt of the head.
That's the difference. Yeah. And he totally got it. And he goes, that's just like Alien. Keep doing it.
Like, I'm excited by proxy 20 years later for you.
And look, and that's the shot that we see in the movie.
Oh, so cool.
That really great shot.
The other thing I was always wondering is, is the breath on the window, is that you or is that a mechanism inside of the head?
That's okay. A steam machine, yeah.
Copy.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure. Yeah. It was close enough that I was like, is maybe someone just using their own practical breath for it?
It was it looked fairly like one of those industrial steamers for your carpets. Yeah, it's like one of those, except like on steroids.
I love it.
So,
in our last 10 minutes, I guess I'll just ask you some random questions, just kind of covering a couple of things. Do you have a favorite puppet that you've helped create? And if so, which one is it and why?
Wow. Well, I think some of the ones we just mentioned plus another one are my all-time favorites. My goal when I'm building puppets is to make a puppeteer-friendly puppet or a puppet that will actually do the action for you so that you're not fighting against it.
Yeah.
And in that respect, I think my best success so far was the Raptors on Jurassic Park. But a real close second behind those is the worms and tentacles from Tremors.
Yeah, totally.
That was a lot of fun.
Okay, what are we looking at size range wise on those? Because, you know, in watching the movie, they all seem gigantic.
We had full size ones and
we
had quarter scale ones.
Okay. So let's hear how like these
gigantic
ones,
worms, yeah.
How are you? Is that fully mechanized? Is someone in the giant worm?
We had, like, when the worm comes out of the ground, that's like three people under the ground with it.
That is so cool.
So it's like two people are pushing the worm up through the hole, and then one person's on this gigantic joystick operating it. They move the head around like this, and then there's a couple more guys on, like, these great big one-armed bandits that are opening and closing its three mandibles for it. So
that is so cool. Awesome. I wanted to ask you, when do you start getting into teaching? How does that happen?
Well, I kind of always wanted to be I didn't always want to be a teacher, but my wife and I had always talked about when, you know, I get up to be as old as I am now, that later on in my life, I think it would be fun to actually try to teach this stuff to people and to share all of that 37 years that I've been doing this stuff. There's just a lot of little tips and tricks that you learn in all that time that you just kind of want to share them. So that was kind of the goal, to always kind of like segue into teaching later in life. And it was kind of a dream. It's just like, this is never going to happen. You know, because it's just not. It's such a different world. And then I saw an ad for NYFA a couple years ago, and I applied, and I got the job.
So what's been different from how you dreamed it would be? Have any, what kind of surprises have hit you as a teacher? What happened that you weren't expecting?
Wow, that's a good question. Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, there were nice surprises where I found that, you know, all of my students have become like family.
Aww.
Which is always really good. I know they have the animation department is a really nice close knit group, and we have a lot of fun.
Yeah, you guys do.
And so yeah, we're always giggling and laughing and I think that rubs off into the students, and they see that, you know, hey, it's okay to have fun too. But I think that was the shock. My first day of teaching, right? Like I go, it's for 2.5 hours of teaching, right? And I go there and I start rattling all this stuff off about matte painting and stuff, and I go blah 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 blah, like, and that's all I got for today. And I realized I'd done all 2.5 hours of my material and in 20 minutes.
Oops.
20 minutes. And I'm like, well, that's all I got today.
Were the students like, that's so much information? It's such a short time.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, so we like went back over it, but we took a big long break.
That's always nice for a first class, is to be like, here's a bunch of information, process it slowly, ask questions, come back. It's helpful. You've worked with like outstanding directors. We mentioned
I've been
Spielberg,
really lucky, yeah.
Tim Burton. I'm blanking.
James Cameron.
That is exactly. Yeah. What I want to ask you who's your favorite, but I know that that's kind of biased. So maybe I'll ask you, what did you learn from working with these guys?
The thing I found in common with all of the best directors, which was, in my opinion, was like Steven Spielberg and Ron Howard and James Cameron, is that they come into a movie with that movie is completely already done inside mm-hmm. their mind. Every single frame and camera angle, for the most part, is made in their mind before they come to set.
We talked to Richard Thorne a little bit a while ago, and he was talking about seeing the animatic for Jurassic Park before it came out, and it's the first of its kind where it's like the whole movie, and he talked about this kind of the VFX community kind of just stopping the tracks and being like, my God, think of the things we can do from here.
Yeah, and not only did we put it on breakdowns, but we did all kinds of crazy stuff on Jurassic Park to prep for that. So by the time we went in to actually do the movies, it was just like, okay, here's a shot. Everybody knows what it is. Let's go do it. And we were getting an unbelievable amount of setups per day. Wow. I mean, we were like one day, we got 40 setups in one day. I mean, that's like working on like an old Roger Corman movie or something like that.
Good Lord.
But we moved and Steven, he got on the average on a lot of stuff. He got a good take on like take three or take four, and we moved on.
Excellent.
And so that was really cool. But when you work for these directors, one thing that's really nice, like for instance, when you work for James Cameron, he's got everything completely designed. He even goes and designs it on paper because he's an amazing artist as well.
Yeah.
So the great thing is that he comes to you as an effects artist and he says, I want you to do this, and I needed to do this and this and this. And it's very, very specific. And so the fact that it is completely specific gives you you're able to completely see his vision, so you're able to construct that vision. Whereas some of the lesser directors will come up to you and says, oh, I need a blue monster. And what else do you need besides a blue monster? I want him to have claws. And so you make a blue monster with claws, and you show it to that director, and they go, it's not what I was looking for. And go back and do this. And it's like, well, and then they'll say, oh, I'll know it when I see it. But then, but by that time, you've designed the monster like 20 times and you've wasted a lot of time.
Yeah.
And so that's why I like working for like people like Tim Burton and Ron Underwood and Jim Cameron and also Steven. The really good directors have already got all of that figured out. So that by the time they get to the set, it's by the numbers, but at the same time, they're not locked into that, right? If they see something like, oh, look, here's a great shot and here's a great opportunity, they're certainly not afraid to veer off the track
they
and go, let's go grab that shot. Yeah.
My friend, my cinematographer friend, he refers to this as allowing for happy accidents.
Exactly.
Like,
serendipity.
When you come prepared,
yeah,
you know exactly what you're looking for, so you can allow creativity to come into it, because not everyone is struggling. Don't be that director, guys, who's like, I'll know it when I see it. There's nothing worse than wasting people's time. These things take a long time already to put together. When you have to guess on top of it, it's next to impossible. What advice would you have to students looking to get involved? Maybe especially to students, I would say, that haven't yet picked an institute. Like, they're not sure if they're going to study, if they want to jump right in. If you're interested in getting into visual effects, special effects, or even puppeteering, what advice do you have to them?
What advice do I have for them? I definitely invite them to, like, if they're interested in this stuff, to first, if they want to do this stuff, go onto YouTube and go and look at the visual effects breakdowns they have of things now, and look and see, because it's great now because you can go on YouTube and you can go, hey, how did they make that stuff on The Martian or Prometheus? And you can go watch the YouTube videos and you see exactly what each little separate element that they made that gets composited together and stuff like that. So I would recommend doing that. I recommend if you're a student, I'd recommend, and like, let's say you're a student and you want to get into 3D animation, right? I would say, use your student ID to create a free account with Autodesk.com, the people who make Maya software, which is the industry leading software for animating this stuff. And you can create an account with Autodesk, and then you can download their software for free and use it. And then, so I'd say, you know, get that, and then go straight to YouTube and start looking at tutorials. and so see if it's for you. Dirty. Yeah, yeah.
Excellent.
If you're doing creatures and stuff, pay attention to all your anatomy physiology classes in high school, because that was in high school I knew I wanted to be a monster maker, and I realized that by learning anatomy and physiology, all that stuff was actually just gonna benefit me. So my whole approach to high school was like looking at a class and going, how can this help me make monsters? And then just really reaching and trying to find even the most obscure thing in that class that would help, you know, hey, this will be handy in making monsters. And just having that little bit of momentum or whatever it is would help me go through that class, because I knew that I was going to be able to apply that to what I wanted to do.
Excellent advice. So. Guys, thank you so much, Craig, for being here and for dispensing all of your amazing wisdom.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was great.
Super fun stories. You're amazing. We're going to have you come back and maybe we'll do a deep dive on one of your movies and really explore the little tidbits of how you got certain things done and how certain scenes were shot.
Would love to.
You've been on some amazing stuff. So thank you. Before we go, if I can get a single camera, we have a small error to correct. On May the 4th, we did a Star Wars Day episode. We had mentioned one of our graduates, Francesco Panzieri, who did special effects. He worked on the feature Rogue One, not Star Wars Episode 7. They came out close together. We got a little confused, so we're super sorry, Francesco. He worked on Rogue One. He did beautiful work. Definitely check it out if you haven't, but we wanted to make sure that that error was corrected. So thank you very much. Until next week, we will be back here, 4 o'clock. Next Thursday, doing a special Pride episode for Pride Month with a former, with a current NYFA alumni who has made this incredible video dedicated to a friend of his. And we'll talk more about that when he's here, because it's a really amazing piece. Pega will be back for that. Thank you guys so much for joining us for episode 21. Thank you again for Craig for being here with
us
tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And we will see you guys next week.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Christian Harloff, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.